This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and in fact I think the invitation was first issued 2 years ago, and I'm sorry it's taken me so long to actually get around to come and speak to you. Today is actually quite a special day because ONS has just come out with some new population predictions about the UK, which you may or may not have seen. I was this afternoon interviewed again by BBC Radio 5 Live, and I will refer to that in a minute. But population is clearly something that people are very interested in. So what I want to do today is take you through some of the narratives surrounding the population. We're going to talk about global population, although a lot of it is going to obviously be relevant to us here in the UK. Talk about the narratives, talk about the myths, talk about the facts and the drivers behind those facts, and the way that when we put those demographic drivers together, the kind of society and economies that we're seeing emerging in different parts of the world because of their different demographies, and the impact it's going to have, particularly on us here in Europe. So I don't know whether any of you know anything about population size. Does anyone know how big the current population of the world is?
7 billion.
Well done, 7 billion. And it was, in theory, on October the 31st last year, so that's October 2012, the UN designated October the 31st as the day that the world hit 7 billion. And yet again, BBC 5 Live rang me up and asked me to do an interview. I'm not quite sure why 5 Live is so keen on talking to me in particular, but I obviously have got into some sort of network and they put me in between the football, actually. But the then presenter said to me, how do we know that the 7 billion baby was born today? Well, of course, we didn't. Of course, the 7 billion baby probably wasn't born that day. In fact, we may well have been in the middle of getting the 8 billion baby for all we know. But I think it showed two very interesting things. That it was of sufficient interest that A, the UN designated it Population World Day and hit 7 billion, and B, a programme like 5 Live, which basically is a sports channel which has the odd thing coming in, actually wanted to do some kind of item on it. So there was great interest. But what naivety that a BBC journalist would actually, for some reason, presume that that was the day. And earlier in the morning, I had a Radio Oxford, exactly the same circumstance. And I think it showed that we really don't, the public didn't really understand population. There are just so many myths out there. When I was a student of demography, the overwhelming question at that time was, how can we stop the world population hitting 24 billion by the end of the century? Then the UN predictions came down to about 12 billion, and then they brought them down to about 10 billion. And until a couple of months ago, we believed that we probably would hit around about 9.8, 10 billion by about 2050, and then the population would flatten and remain at about 10 billion. A couple of months ago, the UN media prediction actually raised itself to 11 billion. And that is the story of Africa and the way that the African population is increasing. And I'm going to come back to that in a minute. But basically, population size and the rampant growth of population, with the exception of Africa, is not something, I think, that we need to be particularly concerned about. Rather, we need to look at the more sort of complex way in which the world population is going. And so it is going to grow in size, but then it's probably going to flatten, and probably by the end of the century, for the very first time in the history of humankind, we will no longer be a growing population, probably. And I say I will come back to that. But we're going to change in different ways. We're becoming far more dense. We now have over half the world's population living in urban areas, and we will have about 75 to 80% of the world's population by the end of the century. Our distribution is changing quite dramatically. Not only do we have tremendous rural-urban migration, but also international migration flows are moving and changing very, very quickly. And as far as I'm concerned, one of the more important things is the age compositional change of the world is changing. The entire world outside Africa is getting older. And the drivers behind this are basically changes in fertility, changes in mortality, and a counterbalance of migration. And we shouldn't be surprised that these changes are happening, because any of you who did sort of basic demography can see that this is to do with the demographic transition and the way the demographic transition is going across the globe. But because it's playing out in different ways, it's having very different effects in different parts of the world. If we just look at what's happening to global fertility, I don't know if any of you know which country in the world currently has the lowest total fertility rate. That's the lowest number of children born to women of childbearing age. Does anyone know where that currently is?
Japan,
Italy, Russia.
Germany.
Germany. You're all sort of vaguely in that area. Portugal. You, sort of. It's actually Hong Kong. Not China, but Hong Kong. Less than one child per woman now in Hong Kong. And the vast majority of the Southeast Asian countries are now lower than the majority of European countries. Korea, 1.2, Singapore, 1.2, urban India and urban Malaysia, around about 1.5. We've had this dramatic fall in childbearing, and we call it actually, if you like, this cliff generation. We have women who have 6, 7, 8 siblings, and they're having one or no child. So basically what we're seeing is the fall in fertility. It took 150 years for Europe to go from being predominantly young to being predominantly old. Asian countries and many Latin American countries are going through this transition in 25 years. They're having to adapt to all the things that we had 150 years to adapt to. Pension systems, long-term care systems, changing from infants and maternal medicine over to midlife and chronic diseases. They've got to do this in 25 years. And it's driven phenomenally by the fall in fertility rates. And if you're interested, we can talk a little bit at the end about why it is that fertility has come down so dramatically, and it's happened in about 20, 25 years. If there is one thing that demographers knew at the end of last century, was that total fertility rates were going to plummet in the South, in the developing and emerging economies. And the exception is Africa. So Africa still has, in almost every country, between 4 and 7 children on average. Nigeria has the highest, that's 7 children born to women on average. And the really big question is, will the African total fertility rate come down to the same level that we've seen in Asia, Latin America, and obviously in the Northern Hemisphere? Now the UN predictions of a maximum world population of between 10 or 11 billion are based on the assumption that the entire world is going to converge at replacement level by the end of the century. But many people are suggesting that possibly in Africa this may well not happen. And we are definitely seeing the stalling of what we call the fertility transition in many African countries. Now it's not unusual for fertility fall to stall when you hit around about 3-4. It happened in Argentina at the end of the 19th century. It happened in Bangladesh about 20, 25 years ago. But if we're going to have stalling in Kenya, where you potentially have 20 million baby girls being born, and you think all those baby girls are going to potentially grow up to be mothers and have at least one child, you can see why if the African total fertility rate doesn't come down, we will not go from 1 million, we've got just under 1 billion Africans at the moment, about 800 million. We're predicting that they will go to about 2 billion by the middle of the century and 3 billion by the end of the century. That will be replaced by 15 billion Africans by the end of the century and a maximum world population of 22 billion. So there's a lot of effort at the moment being put into trying to understand the dynamics of fertility falls in Africa, the role of things like education. One of the reasons why Nigeria is so high is that you have a large percentage of young girls aged 12 and 13 are taken by older men and they're married, and by the time they're 20 they've had 5 births already. And if you can keep these girls in school, then you can keep them out of the marriage market. And if you keep them out of the marriage market, then you reduce their total fertility. But you also give them skills, you enable them to go into the labour market so that they don't just see, you know, that having babies is the only thing they're able to do. And most importantly, you change the mindsets of the women and the communities so they understand why 10, 12 births is not good for women, it's not good for the communities, it's not good for countries. And they hopefully will want to go to what we call the desired two-family norm. And that means that in most countries outside Africa, if you ask people how many children do they want, Most women, in particular, say, I want two children, and they want a boy and a girl, in that order. So there's some really interesting things happening at the moment around fertility, but it's really important because that is what is driving the ageing of the population. And I said that by the end of the century we would go to a very different dynamic. We're going to go from this kind of population pyramid that we've grown up with, lots of young people entering our societies and economies and driving them, to a pyramid that is going to be what the US will have in 2020, which is what we call a skyscraper, from the pyramid to the skyscraper. Every floor of that skyscraper is roughly 10% of the population and roughly a decade of life, 0 to 10, 10 to 20, all the way up until late life, and we'll talk about late life in a minute. But some countries, like Japan, to a certain extent like Italy, maybe like Korea, are going through a vase shape in so much as their fertility is falling so dramatically and their longevity is increasing that they go from the pyramid to the vase before they go to the skyscraper. So that really is the sort of basic story around fertility. What about what's happening at the other end? Well, let's talk very generally about what's happening to mortality, and then at the end of the talk, I actually want to look a little bit into the future. But let's talk about what's happening now. We can say that we've seen dramatic increases in life expectancy in most countries of the world outside sub-Saharan Africa, and even in Africa, we're seeing increases in life expectancy. The countries of the world that have the longest life expectancy at the moment are, interestingly, women in Japan and women in France that have a life expectancy of birth of 88. Women in the UK have a life expectancy of birth of about 82. And although I can see why Japanese women, who are obviously genetically different, and their culture and food in particular is very different, I think it's quite interesting that for some reason French women have a life expectancy of 88 and British women have a life expectancy of 82. And I said this recently, and one man in the audience put his hand up and said, my mother-in-law is French. if you look, however, at the difference between male and female life expectancy, we can say that at the population level, the majority of the OECD countries now have life expectancies at birth, and it's important that we distinguish between at birth and later on, but at birth, of over 80 in most of the OECD countries for women. But there isn't a single country in the world that yet has a life expectancy at birth of over 80 for men. 79, 78, 77, even in the OECD countries. And there's some very interesting stories about this differential life expectancy. People often say to me, why is it that women live longer than men? Without any doubt, there are so socioeconomic factors and environmental factors. So, for example, one of the big killers is smoking. Men, on the whole, tend to smoke more than women. Men tend to be more vulnerable to things like crime. Men tend to be more vulnerable to accidents. But we know that at every age, the male is more vulnerable to death than the female. And there's been quite a lot of research recently looking at the fundamental biology of the body, and I'll just share three pieces of evidence with you. As I'm sure you all know, women have XX chromosomes and men have XY. And what the geneticists are now telling us is that the second X protects, so that most of the genetic information is actually held on the X. And women, if anything goes wrong on that X, have a second X to fall back on. Men who are XY don't have that second X to fall back on. And if you look at the research that's done on birds are YY for male birds and YX for female birds, and male birds live longer. So there clearly is some genetic predisposition which protects women and doesn't protect men. There also is a lot of research around hormones. We've known for some time that estrogen is a protective hormone, but there is now evidence that testosterone isn't just not a protective hormone, it may actually increase morbidity and mortality. And there was some very interesting research, which was historical research, looking at Korean males. And I'm going to give you a hint, men, if you want to live a little bit longer. They were looking at the eunuchs in the Korean court, and they discovered that the castrated Korean males lived up to 20 years longer than the uncastrated ones. So if you want to live longer, you give up smoking and etc. But I leave that with you. The other thing we now begin to realise is actually around the immune system. And for the few women that are in the audience, I have some sort of good and some bad news. And the bad news is that I think manned flu probably does exist, sadly. We now know that, in fact, the female immune system is better at fighting off both bacteria and virus than the male system. We used to think, actually, that women were better at fighting off viruses but more susceptible to bacteria, but we now think that, in fact, both bacteria and viruses are better fought off by women. So it does seem that there's some really interesting biology going on around why women across the globe, once they've passed reproductive age, actually live longer than men. So the fertility mortality story is very simple. We're having less children and we're living longer. And you put those two together and that's why you get the ageing of societies. And I don't want to spend too much time talking about the third demographic variable, migration, but I just want to highlight the fact that migration has very much been used by countries in the north, the European countries, the North American countries, and their sort of sister countries in different parts of the world, to prop up their ageing societies. So over the last 50, 60, 70 years, the countries of the north have tended to export economic capital and import human capital in the form of migrant workers to prop up their ageing societies. And what the evidence that is now coming out of places like the World Bank, the IMF, for example, is that Europe in particular is not going to be in a good place to attract the world's skills. And some very interesting work recently came out of Manpower looking at China. And China is the only country in the world that has mapped its population by occupational structure and age. And it knows at what year it's going to have a downturn in each of its occupations. And Manpower has pointed out that the Chinese are very much gearing themselves up to start cherry-picking the world's skills. They know they can't possibly educate the entirety of their population up to the skills level that they need to drive their modern economy. So they're going to start doing what we have done, which is taking the best talent from the world. And Manpower recently predicted that the brain drain is going to switch from the US across to China in 2030, and I think it's going to happen earlier than that. And that simply means that if you're a bright young graduate from Oxford, you don't go and work for First Boston in New York, you go and work for a bank in Shanghai. But that has real implications for Europe and talent within Europe and how we're going to attract talent. And if you put those two together, the ageing of the population and the downfall of fertility, the OECD has recently mapped entry into and exit out of the OECD labour market, and it took the proxy 20 to 24 and 60 to 65. And by roughly about 2017, 2018, there will be more people retiring from OECD labour markets than coming into them. And that takes into account their assumptions about maximum possibilities from migration. And I'm going to leave this with you because when we come to look at some of the solutions around the ageing populations in Europe, I think we have to bear in mind that we may not always be able to rely on migration as a way of keeping up the talent pool that we have here in Europe. So that's the sort of basic demography. There are two, I think, really big myths out there about how the age composition of the world is going to change, and I'll just share them with you and then look at some of the reality. It's a huge myth out there about what we call the demographic deficit. And this is the idea that Europe, in particular, is going to have this huge dependency issue. And that because our population is ageing, our health services are going to collapse, our economies are going to collapse. And this whole demographic deficit is going to be this big grey burden sitting over Europe. The second, what I think also is a narrative which is possibly a myth, it's around the labour pool that is going to be available in Asia. And again, there's a lot of work being done at the moment looking at the labour pool, particularly comparing the labour pool in China with the labour pool in India. And so, for example, economists in particular who are interested in that relationship between labour and GDP have pointed out that by 2030, China's labour pool will start to decline and India's labour pool will take over. And I think there's a lot of fallacies about taking the labour pool and converting that into a demographic dividend without actually acknowledging it may just be some kind of a youth bulge. Because unless we have the institutions and education in order to capture that labour pool, I think that old relationship between population and GDP has to be questioned as we go forward into the kind of modern economies that we have. So putting all of this together, what kinds of challenges are different parts of the world going to to face. And basically, I think we can divide the world demographically into three categories, and I'm sure as economists you will see that this actually fits very well into some kind of an economic model as well. We have the advanced economies, and the advanced economies are characterised and will continue to be characterised by low and very low fertility, by low and increasingly low mortality going forward, in particular a falling mortality rate among the oldest old, and by an increasing need to have migration into their economies. The emerging economies are going to face different kinds of challenges. They are going to have a population that is reducing its childbearing, but still has the opportunity of this potential, this labour pool, which could be a demographic dividend, but is also seeing the ageing of its population and the need to educate and retain this bulge in the middle. And the least developed countries, which mainly are in sub-Saharan Africa, not exclusively, but the vast, vast majority are faced by still high fertility, still high mortality. And this kind of, in the early stages of this epidemiological transition, when you still have acute diseases and having to cope with some of those issues that come when you have infant mortality, disease, maternal mortality, bad governance, etc. But definitely three very, very different demographic structures there. So I think when we start to put this together, we can say, well, what are the major challenges that are going to face the different parts of the world? And I want to concentrate on the advanced economies and then look a little bit at the emerging economies. And then, actually, as I say, return to mortality and look a little bit at that story going forward. So I think the really big challenges that we're going to be facing in the advanced economies are around this demographic deficit, but the reality of the demographic deficit, and also are going to be around health. So the story around the demographic deficit is that, yes, we are an ageing population, but there isn't necessarily negative about the fact that our average age or our median age of the population is going to increase. I talked about the ONS producing figures today, and they have pointed out that the median age in the UK at the moment is, I think it's 38.7, and it's going to go to something like, there must be 39.7, it's going to go to something like 41 within about 25 years. So it's only a small shift. But if you have a world where you have less younger people coming into your economy, one of the arguments that the economists have made is that this can be very negative, because we know that younger people tend to produce, consume, save, reproduce, drive economies. And we know that older people tend to be quite the opposite. They tend to be less productive, draw down on savings, and therefore the growth in our economies is going to be much less. But that takes a certain presumption that to be 60 or 70 yesterday and today is the same as in the future. And what is very, very clear is that the health profile of people going forwards is likely to change quite significantly. Already we can say that the health profile of a 70-year-old man in this country is the same as his father's was at 57. So already in one generation we've pushed back the kind of onset of some of those late-life disabilities and diseases. And if we're going to have the continuation of this, and all the evidence at the moment is that actually we are pushing back the onset of disability and frailty, then all we're saying is that we actually have a far greater span of active adulthood to draw on. So why on earth are we suggesting that people should be retiring in their 50s, which we still do, although it's much less than it was even 10 years ago, when in fact these people may well be living to 90 or 100? We have an economy that basically, if we were just ageing, it wouldn't be so much of a problem. It's ageing at a time when we're not having enough children, therefore young people, therefore young workers entering our economy. We know that migration is going to be problematic, so one of the solutions is actually that we do genuinely work longer. And if we say that actually working to 75 by 2025 is the same as working to 65 in 1980, which potentially in terms of health it actually is, then we're actually shifting that sort of chronological age, and the ageing of the population becomes far less of a burden. And I think one of the reasons why governments are beginning to think that way isn't just because of the pension burden, but because actually we will need the skills and the experiences of older workers. But that's a huge ask for employers and employees and human resources and issues around training and lifelong work, learning and ergonomics in order to accept that the average age of our working population is going to increase quite dramatically. We recently did some very interesting work for the gas industry, or the oil and gas industry, and they suddenly realised that the average age of men hanging from gantries in the North Sea had gone from something like 35 to 48. Because young people are not going to the oil and gas industry. I mean, if you look at these occupations, there are clear occupations that are attractive, they're basically called sort of media, and there are clear occupations that are unattractive, and they're called health and social care services, and in the middle are a lot of occupations like, manufacturing, industry, transport, that young people just are not attracted to. So the oil and gas industry is not able to recruit the best, and yet it's finding these workers at 48 are doing things that even 10, 15 years ago it thought they would have stopped by about 40. So there's all these issues about the ageing workforce. But if we put it in the light of the whole demographics, that actually Europe has got to maintain people within the labour market, then I think the story becomes very different. And the second big challenge that we're going to face is definitely around health. My story only works if we continue to push back the onset of death and disability. And one of the issues is that with the new pharma in particular, and all those kind of late life interventions, we may be able to accept frailty and disability earlier and then just live longer and longer with it. Unless we can continue to push back through mainly public health initiatives when we're younger, we're not going to be able to benefit from that growing group of people in the 50s, 60s and even 70s that we will need within our economies. So the health story basically is that all of the OECD countries are going to face a change in the amount of ill health that's in the population. We know that as we get older, we have more ill health. And remember, it isn't just that we're all getting older, it's just that the large baby boom cohorts are all ageing. And that's one of the reasons why we're getting, we have a doubling of people in their 80s within the next 25 years. That's because the baby boomers are going to live longer and an awful lot of them are going to be up there being 80. We're going to have a difference in the kind of ill health, and increasingly in OECD countries, acute and infectious diseases are going to almost disappear, and we're going to have far more emphasis on the chronic diseases, so we're going to have a shift in that. And we are very sadly, and we were talking a little bit about this earlier, about Japanese robots, going to have a decline in the care that is available for the kind of chronic diseases when we're older. When we're older, we often don't need high-tech medical, but we do need often hands-on care. But our families are getting smaller, and the potential pool in our OECD countries for helping care workers are getting smaller. So they're two very, very distinct problems. One of them is predominantly driven by falling fertility, and that is what's happened to our labour markets. We're not getting the entrants coming in. And one of them is driven more by falling mortality. We're living longer and longer. So the second big question that I talked about is what is going to happen in our emerging economies. There's some very interesting research at the moment which is comparing India and Pakistan and China. Very different societies, economies, demographies, and cultures. And it is very clear that unless these countries can get their act together on things like institutions, governance, infrastructure, healthcare, and education, it may well not have the kind of economic boom that we've seen in, for example, some of the BRICS countries, but actually we may have considerable unrest as we have large numbers of younger people facing high youth unemployment and excluded from the labour market, because the labour market has not been able to adjust to take them on board. So I think, focusing on what's happening around the demographic dividend and whether the labour pool will become a demographic dividend is also going to be very important. But I want to return a little bit to look at what is really going to happen in the future in terms of longevity, because it's very, very clear that not only are the biologists, but also the demographers, beginning to question some of the life expectancy figures that I've been talking about. If we just go back to the story of mortality and increasing life expectancy, and I'm just going to focus on England, because England has some very, very good data. England and Sweden have some of the best historical data going back, because we had very, very good birth and death records. And we can basically say that what we have done over the last 250 years is push death back a across the life course. We used to have deaths all the way across the life course. You know, babies died, children died, young people died, midlife people died. Now, the vast majority of deaths occur in this country over 65. So much so that in 1850, half the English population did not make it to 45. And now, half the English population will make it to 85. That's the difference that we've pushed back. There are huge inequalities still in our country. We recently did quite a big survey looking at 2 million occupational pension records. These are occupational pension records. These people had jobs and careers and occupational pensions. We're not talking about those people who are on casual labour. But the difference in our spectrum between those people who had low income, low education and poor health at age 65 when they retired, compared to those people who had a higher income, higher education and good health at 65 when they retired, was 11 years life expectancy. Half a million of our pensioners have died. So we can, with quite a lot of power, look at what was driving this. And what is very clear is that those 11 years are made up with a variety of factors. So when we looked at our poorer group, again within an occupational pension scheme, and we saw that these people who at age 65, they had 12 years of life expectancy ahead of them. And we compared that with the group who had over 22 years of life expectancy ahead of them at 85. We can say that if these people had good health and a high educational status and had kept obviously their education up, they could have altered that by about 8 years. So roughly two-thirds of the difference was around good health and good education. So there is going to be huge inequalities going forward. But if we look at what is now happening, let's look at what happened across the century. So if we look at how we've pushed death back, why have we pushed death back? Well, we've pushed death back basically because we've conquered the diseases that used to kill us. We recently took some ONS data and we compared male mortality by different reasons between 1910 and the present. And we can say that across the century, at the beginning of the century, we had a high percentage of deaths from infections, particularly around the Second World War, the First and Second World War. That's almost completely gone. We had high deaths from things like bronchitis and respiratory disease. Again, particularly the influenza epidemic. That is almost completely gone. If we look at what's happened to cancer, in actual fact, interestingly enough, incidence of cancer has gone up, but deaths from cancer has gone down. So that's been more or less stable. But the really, really big success story for men in this country has been around cardiovascular disease. From 1980 onwards, we see a dramatic decline in male deaths from cardiovascular disease. Men dying of heart attacks in their 60s is now very rare. 30 years ago, it was very common. And does anyone know what it was that caused that decline? Smoking. It was a Pito study which showed the public health that came out of that. And I have a man who's shaking his head, so we must have a discussion in a minute. But the Oxford evidence, Oxford likes to say, smoking had a huge impact. That was a public health initiative. Let's look at another public health initiative that is needed around the 21st century epidemic. If the 20th century epidemic was smoking, we can argue that the 21st century epidemic is obesity. Are we reacting in the same way to obesity as we did in trying to conquer deaths from smoking? And again, some very interesting research, again, has come out of Oxford, where we have two very big meta-analyses that were done. One was done out of Oxford between 1979 and 1996, and it looked at the deaths that could have been prevented if obesity had been removed from the population. And the other one asked exactly the same question, but it went from 1996 to 2006. That was called the Meta-Chang analysis. The Oxford one is called the prospective cohort study. Now, at a very time when we know that in OECD countries we have had a dramatic increase in obesity in the population, these studies suggested that actually deaths from obesity were going down. And their argument was because actually we're using drugs. So we are using drugs to compensate for high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and there's other things that things like obesity and unhealthy lifestyle tend to push us towards in terms of chronic diseases. And that has all sorts of health implications. If instead of taking public health initiatives to change our lifestyles, we're going to use technology, medicine, and in particular the pharma industry. But I'm going to end by saying we've seen, as I say, this steady decline in mortality. I said at the beginning one of the really big things we missed as demographers 25, 30 years ago was that fertility would come down. We really missed that late life mortality would plummet in the way that it has. We've seen the biggest fall in mortality rates have been among the over 65s in the last two or three decades. So we're pushing back death further and further. The predictions that the ONS came out with at the end of last year is that we currently have about 12,000 centenarians in this country. We will have approaching 500,000 centenarians by the middle of the century and 1 million centenarians by the end of the century. The statistics that came out today from the ONS say that they now say we've gone to 13,000 centenarians, and that in 25 years' time we will have 100,000 centenarians. That's going to be a dramatic increase to about 2030, and in fact a far slower increase from 100,000 to 500,000 over the next 30 years. 8 million people in the UK are likely to make it to a century. 127 million Europeans are likely to make it to a century. The demographers are telling us that the real life expectancy of today's European babies is probably about 103, 104, and if you live in Japan, it's probably about 107. So we really are pushing back life. The two big questions are, as we push back life, is it healthy life expectancy or is it frail life expectancy? And all we can say at the moment is that definitely we're pushing back the onset of frailty and disability. But it does seem that we're also pushing back the time we spend frail and disabled. The medicine and the interventions that's keeping us healthy for longer is keeping us alive, disabled for longer. And that's going to have real implications for both the economy and also, obviously, for healthcare. And the other big question is, as we get more centenarians, will we get more super centenarians? In other words, those people who are alive over 110, 115. I have to say that the very first recorded super centenarian died at 110, and he was born in 1700. We've always had long-lived people, but we've only ever had a handful, probably about 10 recorded centenarians in the 18th century. The evidence from Japan, where we have a large number of people over 100 now, is that yes, as we're getting centenarians, so the tail is edging out and we are getting more people living over 110, 115. So if people say to you, is there a maximum lifespan? And people often ask this, and up here in our minds, 120 is the longest, 122 is the longest verifiable lived human being that we know of. She was a French woman and she died, I would say 5 years ago, maybe slightly longer than that. So 120 is there. Is that going to be maximum? I think it's highly unlikely that as humans we have a maximum. But on the other hand, are we really going to find people who are going to be living to 150, 200, 250? I think it's unlikely that anyone born today could have lived that. But then I talk to my friends who work in stem cell research, and they work in nanotechnology, and they work in new genetics, and they work in 3D printing. You can now actually 3D print a heart, etc., etc. So it's a really exciting, interesting world, but I think we've only just begun to touch upon the implications, not only of this falling fertility and what it's going to be like to live in a society where we don't have it replenished in the way that we used to, but also that we have increasing percentage and numbers of our population at these extreme ages.